It's a pleasure to be here with you this evening. And as you know, the young people are going to be working tomorrow on 2 Timothy. We're going to look at one text in particular and a principle from it tonight. But we're also going to do just a brief overview of the book. There's a lot of introductory material we won't bring out tonight, but the different speakers tomorrow will be able to go into that more detail. And after that brief overview, then we're going to go in and focus on one single principle out of the book, and it's where in 2 Timothy it says, flee youthful lusts. So you have Paul writing to Timothy, and let's first notice a few contrasts. Paul is, of course, older, and Timothy is younger. Paul is the son of a Pharisee. Timothy, his mother, is Jewish, but he is the son of a Greek. Paul is trained by a famous rabbi named Gamaliel. Timothy had been trained by his mother and his grandmother. Paul, of course, is an apostle, and he selects Timothy and asks him to go with him, and he works with him in the gospel. And let's do just take a minute and read that text in Acts chapter 16. This is on the second missionary journey, Acts chapter 16, verse 1. He came also to Derbe and to Lystra. Behold, a certain disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a Jewess that believed, but his father was a Greek. The same was well reported of by the brethren that were at Lystra and Iconium. Him would Paul have go forth with him. And he took him and circumcised him, because the Jews were in those parts, for they all knew that his father was a Greek. And then off they went. And he's going to be this close associate of the older man, Paul. And later we're going to talk about how young he may have been at this point, which I think is one of the most striking things about Timothy. We'll get into that a little bit later, because when, I'll go ahead and hint at it now, in the epistles to Timothy, when it refers to him as being a youth, that's much later than when he meets him, so he's younger at this time. Paul, we can tell from a number of things, he's a very bold and intense person in his personality. It doesn't mean he was never discouraged. He was sometimes. It never meant that he was never somewhere in fear and trembling. He says that. But you see that in his personality. Timothy may have been less so. He's going to tell Timothy, don't let anybody despise your youth. He's going to tell the Corinthians, now, don't despise him. He's going to talk to Timothy about fear and such. They probably had some slightly, or maybe more than slightly, different personalities. But they're both good men working in the gospel. Real quickly, in chapter 1, it's Paul, the address, Paul to Timothy, and then he refers to Timothy's faith, his mother, his grandmother, the gift that was in him through the laying on of Paul's hands, and his duty in the gospel. Then Paul starts talking about what's been going on with him, and he tells Timothy, don't be ashamed of me. Paul is apparently at this point in a second imprisonment at Rome. So after the third missionary journey, he'd gone to Jerusalem. Within about 2 weeks, he's been arrested. He ends up spending a couple of years in prison in Caesarea, appeals to Caesar, goes to Rome, and apparently is released at some point, but rearrested, and then he will end up being martyred after this. This is in this last period. And in the second part of chapter 1, he refers to people, and again in chapter 4, who had been kind of ashamed of him and his bonds. Now, why would somebody do that? Stop and think for a minute. Can you remember somebody who got ashamed of Jesus once he was arrested? Remember the night Jesus was betrayed? Peter, who loved the Lord, who had been willing to die for him, but on the terms that he was thinking of, and then didn't understand when Jesus gave up and let the bad guys win. He went and he followed after to see what was going to happen. And Jesus has been captured. The bad guys are winning. And there and there, and the maidservant says, you are one of them. And what does Peter do? He's a coward, and he's ashamed. I don't know him. Somebody else, yeah, you were with him. No, not me. Well, some brethren have been scared and ashamed about Paul, and he's reminding Timothy, don't do that. In chapter 2, there's going to be just a number of admonitions. He's going to say, be strong. Teach others, suffer, he's going to give some illustrations of how Timothy needs to keep his focus from being a soldier, an athlete, a farmer, etc. Consider what I'm saying. Remember what you need to remember and endure things. And then he's going to tell him to be careful about how he handles the word and to tell other people, have them not getting off in the kind of strife that they would sometimes get into and such. And there's this very specific warning about the Gnostics. We'll talk some later about what the Gnostics were. First Timothy has a lot to do with them. They were some people that had some really, really weird ideas. Back in the 1940s, we discovered their writings, and they are really bizarre ideas. And one of the things that they taught was that the resurrection had already happened. Not just Jesus' resurrection, but the resurrection. It had already happened. And this was one of the heresies going around. He talks about that some. And then he gives an illustration about vessels. He said, in every house, there's some vessels. Some are for fine use, and some are not. And he said, make yourself a vessel of good use. Make yourself a vessel of honor, not a vessel of dishonor. And then he says, flee youthful lusts. And then he ends with saying in chapter 2, saying, teach people, but don't just get involved in strife. And then last, coming up here in chapter 3, he's going to say there's going to be a lot of problems. It's going to not only get bad, it's going to get worse. And the solution, he points him to Scripture. That's where you need to find correction. That's where you need to find instruction, etc. The last chapter of the book, he tells Timothy, preach the word. The time's going to come when they're not going to want to listen to sound doctrine. They're going to want to hear what they want to hear. They're going to find people to tell them fables and different things. He's telling Timothy, you keep preaching the word. And then he says, you fulfill your ministry. And I see in the transfer, I made a mistake there somehow on that word. But you fulfill your ministry, and my race is finished. I'm coming up to the end here. And there's some very interesting final notes. So that's just in a brief nutshell kind of what's going on in 2 Timothy. So just reviewing it real quick. There's your chapter 1. There's your chapter 2. It's not that chapter 2 is all that much bigger or more important necessarily than some other place. It is longer than some of them, but just all those admonitions, it just took more time on the screen. There's your chapter 3, and there's your chapter 4. All right, now let's focus what we want to talk about tonight, and that's this one verse about flee youthful lusts. And in getting into that, I do want to talk a little bit about Timothy's age. So here's a timeline. Jesus dies about 30 A.D., give or take. And see, here's some dates that we have kind of locked in from history, okay? When Paul got to Corinth and some of our fonts just didn't work out there, so I'll try to figure out something tomorrow on that. But when Paul goes to Corinth, it's right around the year 50. Might be a few months this way, might be a few months that way. We know that from archaeology because the guy that was proconsul there at the time. Another date we're pretty locked in on is when Paul goes before Festus. And so these dates we have pretty much locked in on. It helps us build a rough chronology of New Testament times. Now, stop and think back. How old was Paul when we first see him? The first time we see him, Saul of Tarsus. Who's dying? Stephen. Stephen is being stoned, and they lay the coats at the feet of a young man named Saul. So at that point, he is a young man. And so that's supposed to be kind of fuzzy at the end because we don't know exact birth or date. But if he was a young man back at that point, and then when he writes to Philemon, which is about the same time, a latter part of his life here toward this also, he says he's an old man. That gives us an idea kind of Paul's time frame here. And yet Timothy, he will talk to, when he picked him up, he's talked about in reference to his mother and his father. I think he's a young man still living at home. Good chance he may be a teenager. Because later, when he talks about don't let anybody despise your youth and flee youthful lusts and such, this is on into the 60s. If in the 60s, coming up, you know, a few years into the 60s, if he's still a youth, how old was he in the late 40s? Timothy may have been a teenager when Paul... And stop and think about this. Do you imagine Paul was the easiest fellow to please? To just anybody. Well, anybody wants to come, just come. John Mark. who was Barnabas' cousin. What did Paul say on the second missionary journey? No, we're not taking him. He didn't step up enough last time. Now, of course, later he speaks favorably of John Mark, but Paul's looking for people that he can really, really rely on. And he picks Timothy, who, based on this, I would suggest might have been just a teenager at the time that he picks him up. All right. Wow, all of these are going to be messed up. So, 2 Timothy 2:22, flee youthful lust. Let's talk about this. This principle is so important, you know, to flee or not to flee. Let's look at a few biblical examples. So, Joseph, open your Old Testament. Classic case of what's going on here. In Genesis chapter 39, you know the situation. He's working for Potiphar. He's a servant of Potiphar. And Potiphar's wife is pursuing Joseph. Verse 12. She caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." What does Joseph do? He left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. Paul will say in 1 Corinthians 6, flee fornication. To the Corinthians, he will say, flee idolatry. And here, flee youthful lust. The idea of fleeing is really important, and sometimes you do it in a very real physical way. What does Timothy do? Now, Joseph. Joseph's a young man. He's not married, and here's a woman interested in him. Is that flattering to a young man? What does he do when she grabs hold of him? He doesn't say, "Well, let's sit here and hold hands. Let's cuddle. Let's talk about your feelings for me and why maybe we shouldn't pursue." No, that's not the thing to do. You know what the thing to do was? Flee. And that's what he did. And got out of the house. Over in Proverbs chapter 5, there's a lot of warning against the adulterous woman. It says, don't go near her door. Lots of times we get into sin because we're not fleeing sin. We're like kind of interested in that. I don't want to complete. It's kind of like raise your hand if you've ever seen Niagara Falls. Anybody here? All right. Now, that's pretty powerful. Up over here on the right, if you're on the Canadian side, there's a river. Now, let's imagine you're in the river, the Niagara River. If you're far enough away, I'm sure you can swim, be in a boat, you know, whatever, if you are a long, 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 long way away. But imagine how foolish it would be if you're in a boat on the Niagara River and somebody says, "Hey, you know, Niagara Falls is just a few miles down that way." And you decide you want to get a little closer and see what it looks like. And so you're coming along in the boat, and somebody says, "This is not a good idea. Oh, we're not going to go over the fall. We just want to get a little better look, want to see what..." I think I can hear it. I think, is that it up there? You can see what's about to happen. The thing to do as you're getting close to Niagara Falls is not, and you're in the Niagara River, is not see how close you can get to it. What do you need to do? You need to get out of there. Flee. And that's what Joseph did. Job talks about, "I made a covenant with my eyes not to look on a maiden." Now, can you think of somebody who would have really benefited by this principle if they would have followed it at a certain point in their life? David. So, David, he's on the housetop, and he looks, and he sees a woman bathing. What should he have done right then? If it would have been Job, what was Job's covenant with his eyes? Not to look on a maid. So if it went Job, he would have looked at, "Oh, I don't need to look there." Right there. And then, what might be another good idea? Stay up here on the rooftop. Okay, I'm going to look over this way. I'm going to look over that way. Maybe, no, it might be a good idea to just what? While she's out there, I'm not going to stay on the rooftop. I'm going to go do something else and get away from right here. And so if Job had been on the rooftop that day, whatever number of men got killed by that you know, selfish order to Joab to have him, you know, all those people wouldn't have died. Whoever found out their daddy got killed that day wouldn't have had to find that out. Whoever found out their son or daughter, their son got killed that day wouldn't have had to find it out. Whoever found out her husband got killed that day wouldn't have had to find it out. Uriah would have been fine. But David doesn't flee, does he? He looks. And then he asks, who's that? That's the wife of, you know, it would have been a good idea to have done what Job did before. But if you've been stupid once, don't use it as an excuse to be stupid twice. David now is stupid twice. As soon as he hears that's the wife of, it would have been real good if he would have realized, you know, I don't need to be looking. It's the wife of Uriah, one of his servants. But the foolishness continues. And the arrogance at that point in David's life. Sin for. And you know the rest of the story. And it leads to adultery. And it leads then the need to cover it up, or the desire to cover it up. That's, by the way, when people think, oh, I need to cover this up. No. Things need to be exposed. Certain things. If they're not repented of and it's a problem, when you let the sunlight hit something, that can help clean up some things. But instead, he tries. It just gets worse and worse. And so he ends up trying to get Uriah to come home. That doesn't work. So he writes the order, gives it to Uriah, who takes it back to Joab. And it says, go up to a dangerous spot and pull back so that he'll be killed. But of course, you remember what happened. A number of people. We don't know how many. But some number got killed. And when they went back and told David, Joab said, just make sure that if he's angry about it, you tell him Uriah is dead. And do you remember David's words? That was really cold and sad. He said, don't let this thing displease you. And unfortunately, that's what David was doing. Don't let it bother you. He should have let that bother him. And Nathan the prophet is going to help David have that arrogant spirit burst and be able to be of use to God again, because he's going to tell him the story about the sheep and get his heart back into control so that he can be of use again, and it's going to require this to bother him. But on that day, his answer was what? Don't let it bother you. Don't let it displease you. And it all started with what? Didn't flee. There was a brother in Alabama a few years ago. Some of you may know this story better than I do, but he was on death row and I believe was ultimately executed. He didn't do like some people and try to say, oh, I'm a Christian now, so don't execute me. He had been found guilty. He had been brought up in a church there in Alabama, but he'd got running with the wrong crowd, and one thing led to another. It started off with, I think, some drinking and smoking, and then led to some other things, and then some theft. But one time it eventually got to the point that there was home invasion and the homeowner was killed and he was on death row. And I understand that during that time he was talking it, you know, by writing to young people and telling them, don't make the mistake I did. Because what he did was just started down the wrong path. Flee from these things. All right, and we'll see. Yeah, there we go. Thank you. All right. So, let's talk a little bit about the Corinthians, too. We don't have time to go into this in any detail, but some of you are familiar with the fact that in 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10, Paul is responding to them because they want to be able to go to the idol temples and take part in the feasts. Because they did that throughout their lives. They enjoyed that. There was good food there. It was part of their social life. They liked to do it. And so now they're looking for rationalization on why they can do it. And let me tell you, once you get into trying to rationalize why you can do something, I've heard some amazing mental gymnastics that people can do to come up with a reason why they ought to be able to do something wicked and foolish. Well, the Corinthians ones, they're saying, well, we're smart. We know, we have knowledge, and we know that God's not really real. So we can go there to the idol temple. We can take part in the feast. And we're not really worshiping the God because we don't, et cetera. And Paul's dealing with this, and he answers them on a number of levels. One of the ways is he says, yeah, you have knowledge. Knowledge puff you up. What you need is love. And thinking about how this affects other people. And he talks about some more direct things in chapter 10 we won't get into right now, except for this. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 10. He says in verse 13, there's no temptation taken you. Well, let's get verse 12 also. Let him that thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. When we start saying, well, I can do this because I'm strong enough, I'm smart enough, I'm knowledgeable enough, I'm a mature enough Christian, I can handle this. A good friend of mine ended up falling in love with a woman that wasn't his wife. And he told me, he said, my mistake was just being arrogant. I thought, it can't happen to me. So here was a woman, and she was having troubles, and instead of saying, my wife and I will talk to you, he made a foolish decision that he would just talk to her. Well, and she really appreciated that. And then that can develop the fellow, I want to help her, and see, oh, I've got someone to listen to me. And then they end up falling in love with each other, and of course causing a lot of hurt and harm, and he repented, and he and his wife are still together today, and I'm glad for it. But there was a huge amount of hurt and problems, all caused because he rationalized and didn't understand the danger that he was getting into. Let him that thinks he stands, oh, I'm strong enough. Oh, they said that was a really filthy movie. Well, I'm strong enough, I can watch it, it won't affect me. Well, they say there's going to be a lot of drinking and drugs. Well, I'm strong enough, it won't affect me. What would a strong person be doing? Does anybody think Paul was strong? What was Paul's advice? Flee! Was Joseph strong? What did he do? Flee! Let him that thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. There's no temptation taking you, but such as man can bear. Everybody listen to this. Have you ever told yourself this? I just can't help myself. Maybe it's your temper. Maybe it's an issue with lust. Maybe it's jealousy. Maybe it's something else. I just can't help myself. Maybe it's alcohol. Maybe somebody's on a drug. And see, I just can't help myself. I just can't help myself. Listen to what this passage says. There is no temptation taking you but such as man can bear. God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation make the way of escape. Well, what might it be? Well, where could I find an escape? Look at the next verse. Remember, he's talking to people who are trying to snuggle up to idolatry. That's the sin that's in danger here. And he gives a solution. You know what the way of escape is? Look at verse 14. Flee idolatry. That's the solution. Let's move now. I want to look at three last things before we wind up in a few minutes later this evening. And they are this. Direction, perspective, and replacement. Direction. What direction is our life going in when we flee sin or when we don't? Perspective in how to look at things long-term instead of short-term. And replacement. One problem that people get into is that sometimes when they try to put away a sin, they don't replace it with something good. And if you just try to empty something out, but you don't put something back in its place good, you're going to run into trouble. And so the passage in 2 Timothy doesn't just say, flee youthful lusts. It said, flee youthful lusts and pursue righteousness. When you choose to start getting busy in the fruits of the Spirit, then the works of the flesh are not so tempting. If you don't get busy in the fruits of the Spirit, and you stand there looking at the works of the flesh, just saying, well, I've got to stay away from it, got to stay away from it. You're asking for defeat. You need to not be looking in that direction. You need to look in another. So let's talk about these three things. Hebrews 11:25 refers to Moses' decision not to accept and stay in the pleasures of sin for a season. It points out something. A lot of sin is pleasurable. There are some sins I don't see much pleasure in. Jealousy. I don't understand, you know, the desire for, you know, why would somebody want to be jealous? I get why somebody might want to rob a bank. Horrible idea. You're a horrible person if you do it. But if you rob the bank and you get away with it, is there some benefit? Yeah, for a little while you've got some money until you get caught and are condemned by God and go to hell. But for a little while you had some money. A lot of sins, there's something up there. There's a few like jealousy. I mean, right from the get-go, you're miserable. And then it gets worse. But in a lot of sins, there is pleasure available. But how does that pleasure tend to go? So, Art Adams was with us a few weeks ago. I preach in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And Art Adams is a gospel preacher, and he's also a social worker. And y'all may have had him here sometime, come to think of it. Okay, very good. And if you remember when he talked about addiction, you might have seen a chart that looked a little bit like this. And I remember talking with a friend of mine that was, he was a drug dealer and a drug addict, ended up in prison. I remember when I went to see him in prison, he was glad I came. The church had had to withdraw from him sometime before. But when he was in prison, I got there and said, none of my drug buddies have come to see me. Well, big surprise. But he told me this one time about cocaine. He said, you spend your life trying to recreate your first high, and you can't. So the first time with a lot of drugs and a lot of substance abuse, now, there are some of them that the very first time it's horrible on the person, and sometimes they die the first time. But with a lot of them, there is a great high that the person really, really feels good. And it lasts how long? Not that long, and then you crash. Or if you get drunk, you know, you're getting a buzz, the person's starting to feel good. Now in the next morning, you wake up, you got a hangover, you're throwing up, you know, and that type of thing. It doesn't feel good now, but it felt good then. And Art said, because he deals with the drug addicts a lot, if you remember when he talked about this, he said they eventually, if here's like normal, and by taking the drug or the alcohol, you feel so much better than normal, but then you crash down, and then you go up, but not as high. And then, he said, after a while, they're way down here. They come up some, but then they go down, and they say, I'm just trying to feel normal. So normal's gone. And now they're having to abuse the substance just to try to get back up to normal. And they can't. And they keep trying to do it, and of course it keeps destroying their body and causing other problems, and there's the spiritual destruction that it does to them, and the terrible things it does to their family and loved ones and everyone else, and they just destroy themselves. So, there's a verse in the Bible that kind of describes this process. Look at it with me, please, in Proverbs chapter 23. Proverbs chapter 23. If you watch beer commercials, bourbon commercials, whiskey commercials, do they ever show you the wino or the drunk guy or the guy sitting in the drunk tank or the miserable guy at happy hour? Is that who they show in the commercials? No, they show happy people, laughing people, young people, attractive people, and everybody's having a good time. And of course, the purpose of the marketing, why are they all having a good time? Look what they've got. And so you think, oh, if I would drink that, that will be my life. Proverbs chapter 23, verse 29. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has strife? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those who tarry long over wine, those who go and try mixed wine. Do not look at the wine when it's red, when it sparkles in the cup, and goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Your eyes will see strange things. Your heart will utter perverse things. You'll be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, like one who lies on top of a mast. They struck me, you'll say, but I was not hurt. They beat me. I did not feel it. When shall I awake? I must have another drink. At the beginning, it what? It looks good. It sparkles. It goes down smooth. But then what's the result? If you were Satan, and you're trying, just like the apostles were to be fishers of men, suppose if you were Satan and you're fishing for people, what are you going to want to put out there? You're going to want to put bait out there, right? Those of you guys that fish. Now I know there's different type of lures and stuff, but let's just take you're on a creek and you're fishing for brim or something, right? Do you just put a hook out there by itself? Do you tell all the brim, say, I want some supper, and anybody that bites this hook, I'm going to destroy you and eat you? No, you have to do what? You got to put something on there that's tasty to that fish. And so here he comes along, and he's not paying attention to the hook, is he? It's like, oh, there's a worm. And gets it. Now, does his pleasure last very long? No, it doesn't. And then later he's going to be in your skillet, and that's it. Sin tends to do this. There's some pleasure you get right up front, and then there's consequences. Why do people tell lies? I can get an advantage if I tell this lie. Or I can avoid being accountable if I tell this lie. I can get away with it. So there's an advantage. Are there consequences to becoming a liar? Yes. Can you lose your job? Yes. Can you find it hard to get a job? Yes. Can you have your family not trust you? Yes. And there's consequences. But right up front, oh, I got to tell a lie. All sorts of sins offer you something right up front. You look at the story of the younger son and the lost son, prodigal son story. Right at the beginning, when he had all the money and he went to a far country to get away from responsibility and fellowship with his father, do you suppose he might have been having a good time while he still got all the money? But then what happens? Yeah, he ends up feeding pigs. A Jewish boy ends up feeding pigs and wishing he could have the pig food. And what happens? When he came to himself, he realized how foolish he had been. Satan's ways put bait out there. Don't take the bait. Flee from it. And so you can see it in substance abuse, dishonesty, promiscuity. So, there's going to be some people, it's Friday night, there's people headed to bars and nightclubs and all sorts of things, and they're just looking for some other loose person so they can have some fleshly pleasure tonight. There's all sorts of consequences to that. For one, there's just a huge number of STDs out there now. And so people, as Proverbs 5 says, their flesh ends up being consumed. They end up betraying things. And I was with a friend just recently in another state in a meeting, and just really, really, really sad. He's doing well now, and I'm proud of him. And he's worshiping the Lord. And he's looking to reach out to other people. But he's a very, very young man. And now he's alone. Because of his behavior. And because of what he did. And in relationship to his marriage that he no longer now has. And now he has no right to be married. Because of his foolishness. And his selfishness. And his sins. And all the consequences came in. I'm proud of him because after destroying a lot of his life, he's done what the younger son did in Proverbs 15, and he's returned to his father. and he knows that he lived unworthy, and like the prodigal son says, just let me be a servant. And the Father in mercy brings him back. But there's all sorts of consequences. Pornography as well. At the university, some of them, and these are universities that aren't concerned about what the Bible says. They're not concerned about let marriage be had and honorable among all, for the adulterer and the fornicator God will judge, Hebrews 13:4. They don't believe that. They're not concerned about that. They're not concerned that a man leave father and mother and be joined to his wife, and as Jesus said, you know, what God joined together, let no man put asunder. They don't care about that at all. But they're trying to counsel the young men at the universities, not because they want them to live a moral lifestyle, but just because they are so messed up from all the time they've spent in pornography that they can't function as a homo sapien relating to other people in the ways the university thinks that a healthy person should, which is without morals and without responsibility. But they're even messed up there because they got in sin and got in deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And then the original sin is not enough. Now it needs to be worse and worse and worse and worse. And lives have been destroyed. And people have ended up in prison. And people have ended up in psychiatric wards. And all kind of things. Because what could have been avoided back before? Flee youthful lusts. Now with all of that, let's just contrast that to the ways of God. Satan, like a crooked car dealer, if you're a crooked car dealer, and if I'm a crooked car dealer and I want to sell you a car, and I know it's got a lot of rust in it, and I just put some Bondo on there and spray painted it, and I know that the transmission's really bad and I put some sawdust in there, when would I like you to see that car, and how long would I like you to examine it? In the dark, in the rain, where it looks shiny, and don't try to say, listen to that, oh yeah, sounds good. And I want you to drive away after you've handed me the cash, thinking, oh, this is great. Down the road, you're going to find out differently. When you've got a bad product, you have to, you know, put the, when you see the movie and they put the suitcase and it's supposed to have the $1 million in it, and it's all newspaper except the top. They never put the newspaper on the top and the few $100 bills on the bottom. The $100 bill's going to be on the top, and then all the fake stuff's underneath. Notice how God's ways are in contrast to that. Does God start with giving you the very best, and then it deteriorates? Let's think about it. Old covenant, new covenant. Which one's better? Hebrews. The old covenant came first, and what came later? The better. In Peter, we read about the milk of the word and the meat of the word, which comes first. The milk and then the meat. This body that is fearfully and wonderfully made, but the resurrected body will be what? Incorruptible and immortal, which comes first. Do you remember at the wedding of Cana? When, because what they would do back then, you would give the better tasting stuff early, and then later, the cheap stuff that doesn't taste as good. Sometimes I've had, like, young people over for pizza, and I'll buy some nice pizzas. Then I'll have a few frozen pizzas back up just in case people are hungrier or we have more people. I don't start with the cheap frozen pizza. You know, what's always the best slice of pizza? The first one you eat. Later, we'll throw that out there if we needed to. When Mary says they've run out of wine, make some, then the master comes, he says, you saved the best for last. And notice how that's how things tend to work in God's system. I don't make here just a permanent upline, not because good isn't always good, but just here reflecting that life does have up and downs and sorrows and different things. But when a person applies God's principles, are they going to get more foolish or are they going to get wiser as time goes by? Are they going to get weaker or are they going to get stronger? And when they start following the blessings of God's instruction for the home and different things, is that going to be more distress or more joy and rejoicing? Which way does Satan's path go? which way does God's path go? So the question is, which way do you want to go? Last couple things here, and then I'll be done here in just a very few minutes. I hope this is the marshmallow test. Some of you are familiar with it. There's been some recent research where people said, no, there's other things that come into play, like if you're brought up in a home where food is scarce, you learn to just take what's there. But in homes where there's enough stability, you don't have that type of problems, this really does tend to play out. And this was done originally back in the 60s. People have repeated it different times. What it is, you put some little kids, 4, 5, 6 years old, in a room, and you say, the researcher puts a marshmallow in front of them. And they say, I'm going to leave. When I come back, if the marshmallow is still there, I give you another one. And then they leave. And, of course, the camera's running. And if you want to see some of these kids, you can look online and watch them. And some kids that have self-control, they'll sit there and they'll wait. And some kids are like, and all other things being equal, if there's not that they live in a home where you never know when food's available and such, all other things being equal, I read one article years ago, it said that on your emotional quotient, which measures your ability to make decisions emotionally, they said your success in life depends more on your EQ than your IQ. You can have a very smart IQ, but if you've got a low emotional, you can't delay gratification. Not you can't, but you won't. And you're foolish. You can make a mess of your life. I remember watching one time, I was at a friend's house, and they had a program about intervention. And there was a young man whose parents... they showed it back in high school. He'd gone to like one of the famous universities at like age 14 because he was that much of a prodigy. He'd been on Jeopardy when he was a teenager and I guess won a bunch of money. He's brilliant. But he wouldn't control himself, so he'd got into gambling. His parents had lost their house, and after they're losing their house, you see him screaming at his mom, I need $20,000 to pay off another gambling debt. He just destroyed his life. The kids... that when the researcher walks out the room and the kid goes, they heard that they could have two if they would wait. They don't care. They don't want to wait. What's going to happen to them when they get a credit card? What's going to happen to them when they go to the party and say, oh, you should try this, it'll feel really great. You see all the things that are going to happen? But the children who realize, I could have one marshmallow now, but in 5 minutes, I could have two. They do better in school. They do better in life. You see how this relates to that last chart? Last point. 2 Timothy 2:22. Flee youthful lusts. And if you look back to the text of Timothy, I want you to see it there. As we wind to close, 2 Timothy. 2:22. Flee youthful lusts and follow after righteousness, faith, love, peace with them that call on the Lord out of a pure heart. Our job is not just to not do bad things. You know, if your idea, well, a Christian doesn't steal, doesn't get drunk, doesn't rob, doesn't cuss, doesn't do all those things, you know what? This is not a Christian. It doesn't steal. It doesn't cuss. It's always at church. It doesn't use the Lord's name in vain. But it doesn't follow. It doesn't obey Christ. It doesn't serve him. It's not a Christian. Being a Christian doesn't just mean here's things I don't do. It means there's things that you do. And so if a person is trying to get away from a sin, it's not going to be very effective to just say, okay, I just won't do that. I wish I could do that. I won't, but I wish. Get busy doing something else. So, the time that you might have been pursuing that sin, find something else to fill that time with. those friends that were getting you in trouble, start spending some time with some better friends. Find somebody in the congregation that needs some help. Maybe an elderly brother or sister that needs some work done on the house or you know, around the yard, and get together with some other friends and go help them and do that. And you'll be surprised how fulfilling that is if you haven't done that. Find good things to do and start learning, start growing. Galatians chapter 5. The flesh and the spirit, they're against each other, and the more you do of the one, the less you want to do of the other. So don't just flee sin, but pursue righteousness. Thank you so much for your attention this evening. And young people, we'll be continuing our studies with the different other people participating tomorrow. I really thank you for your attention tonight, and let's remember these principles. Thank you.